I had a high school girlfriend who had come from Russia. She'd emigrated around second or third grade. And at some point, we were hanging out, and I asked her about her parents, who were both IBM engineers. In fact, they even shared the same cubicle. And I kind of asked the question that in the 1980s, you were always inclined to ask, which is, how did you get here to come over to the U.S.? And she told me a story, and it was told to me in a way that was really funny because it was obvious she had told it a number of times before, and it wasn't very interesting to her anymore, but it was extraordinary to hear. What she said to me was, well, my father was an engineer, and then he didn't really do his engineering as well, so they fired him. And he went to work for an office company and didn't do his job very well, so they fired him. And then he got a job as a car mechanic, which he did okay. And then he applied to move to the U.S., and nobody cares about a car mechanic. So he came to the U.S., and he became an engineer. I remember just looking at her. What an incredible story, told so simply. So it's time for me to give you three extraordinary stories. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It, a podcast about technology, history, and getting myself out of debt. Thanks to Daniel Boyd and the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. Quake 2 was being released, and as someone who had experienced the release of the original Quake, I figured Quake 2 was going to be mind-blowing. At that time, you could keep track of what was going on at id Software by looking at the plan files of different developers. You had something in the old days called Finger. If you fingered a user, you could look at their user information, and if they were working on a project, they were editing a .plan file in their home directory, and that would give you their status. For reasons I've never quite understood, the game makers at id would set their plan files all the time with their thoughts. They were, in fact, early blogs. You would read what was going on in John Carmack's mind today or find out what Tom Hall was planning. And so that's how I found out about a contest. They asked you to make a Quake-themed photo or artwork, and in return, they might send you a copy of the game. At the time, I was working at an office that had a parking garage next to it with multiple levels, and I convinced a bunch of friends to work together to bring next-level artwork to the Quake logo contest. Here's what we did. First, we went to Costco and bought many jars of bulk tomato sauce. And then we got a small group of people to come to the parking garage late at night. It was cold, it was windy, and everybody was huddling for warmth. Everybody was given very old disposable clothing, which they put on, and then I had them lie down in the shape of the Quake logo. And when it was all arranged, I then began to splatter them all with the tomato sauce. By the time we were done, it looked like a murder scene, with a bunch of bodies covered in blood in the shape of the Quake logo. The layout of the parking garage allowed us to put a camera one level above and get a top-down shot. The photo was taken, digitized, and sent in. And really, that's the end of it. They mentioned it, they linked to it, and that's all that ever happened. I always think back to my coworker Mark, my coworker Jim, and a bunch of people from the Tiny Tim mush that I was part of, and their willingness to throw themselves into this project with no known benefit and nothing for themselves that would have been like money or fame or really anything except for the chance to be part of a project. While it was great that we put this together in just a couple days, the extraordinary part is how all those friends got together just because. Just because. The building that Cow.net was in was an artist's colony. It had incredibly cheap rent. It had many different large rooms that were used back when it was a business and a factory. And it was a really weird place to visit. But I had such a fun time there, and the idea of roughing it and living in places that really weren't designed for people still held some fascination for me. So at some point, I actually looked at getting an apartment there. So-called apartments at this building were actually very large rooms, often with balconies or huge second levels, and you were going to pay a very cheap price for them. But they also didn't have showers, and they only had basic hookups for a bathroom. In other words, you weren't supposed to live there. It was supposed to be, simply, a studio. Even in the small amount of time I spent there, I knew this wasn't the case. But when I called the landlord about the possibility of getting an apartment there, we talked for a while, and I ended up going in a different direction. But I'll always remember the extraordinary way he told me we would have to deal with people living there. He told me, unofficially, officially, unofficially, that it was actually okay to live there, except it was kind of illegal. So here's what they would do. A couple times a year, somebody would report the building, tell the city there's people living there when they really shouldn't be. And this was usually done by somebody who was leaving the building, who had gotten into a fight or added drama. But essentially, they'd snitch. So the city would call the building and let them know they were going to do an inspection in the next week. They'd give them an exact date, even. At that point, the residents of this building, of which there were about 20 or 30, would go into a pretty interesting mode. Together, people would pool their money and rent a tractor trailer. In the back of the tractor trailer would go boxes and mattresses and everything that you would have if you were living in a location. After it was all filled up, they would drive the tractor trailer down the street, lock it up, and leave it there. The inspector would show up, walk through all the studios, note that there were no dishes or mattresses or any indication people were living there, mark it off as you are definitely following the rules, and go away, and then they would have a huge moving party and move everybody back in. The landlord told me this with such clarity, with such forthrightness, I could only imagine how many times this little dance had gone on. Ultimately, I declined my seat at this table, my part of this dance. I ended up living in a very normal apartment, in a very normal house, a little bit from my work, and never once did I have to throw all the contents of my bedroom and kitchen into a truck for a day. I was living in Boston, and I found out through Slashdot that the world's largest Tetris was in Rhode Island. By that I mean, a bunch of students at a university had gone ahead and put Christmas lights into the side of a library building that was about 15 or 16 stories high. So, as the story went, you could go to the courtyard, look up at this library, and play it as if it was a large game of Tetris. This was irresistible to my friend Jim and I. So we loaded into a car, we drove down to Rhode Island to a place we'd never been before, seeking out the Tetris. Ultimately, we found the university, and luckily, the library building was tall enough that you could see it from a distance. So we simply drove towards the Tetris game. We waited in line, walked up to the controls, and started playing this library building. We did a couple rounds, and then we turned to let more people play. And I said, "Why, hello, Mr. Wozniak." Because You see, Steve Wozniak was right there. He had flown in especially for this Tetris game, easily and handily beating the dozens of miles that my buddy and I had driven trying to see this game. The nice thing about meeting this person for the first time, who had designed one of my favorite computers, who had been such an influence on me, was how friendly he was. What I remember him saying to me was, "You know, more people have been in space than will ever have played this game of Tetris." He was friendly, he was outgoing, he answered all of our stupid questions, and he played a couple awesome games of Tetris. I don't remember his score, I don't remember if anybody won. I know my buddy and I were debating whether or not this ride was going to be worth it. And as we were driving back, with stars in our eyes, having met a technological god, we both thought it is always worth it to take a leap towards the unusual, because you never know what's going to be there when you land. This is Jason Scott Talks His Way Out of It. Thanks to Forrest Fuqua, James Bakoyanu, Mark Pilgrim, Scott McGrady, Scott Roseanne, Wayne Arthurton, and Joshua Stein, as well as the hundreds of other supporters on Patreon and elsewhere, who have been supporting me and helping me get out of debt. That was the first time I met Steve Wozniak, but I've been pretty lucky and bumped into him here and there at different events. He's always been nice, always informative, full of stories and trivia. He is, in other words, an inspiration in a very specific way. I've tried whenever I can, if somebody comes up to me and has heard of me and wants to talk to me, to try to be like Steve. He's truly my template for being a reward for taking the chance at meeting a hero. They always say don't meet your heroes. I try, because Steve tries, to be the exception.